Okay, so now we're going to talk about Thomas Aquinas. And his name, Thomas Aquinas, his followers are called Thomists, because his name is really Thomas. Aquinas just lets us know he was from Aquino, Italy. But most people call him Aquinas. And so you end up with all these brilliant thinkers. And if you're the kind of guy who, when you're trying to memorize people's names in history, and you remember them by their first letter of their name, you're not going to get anywhere in the history of Christian thought or the history of Christian apologetics, because you got Augustine, you got Athanasius, you got Anselm, you got Aquinas, you got Albert the Great. I mean, there's just so many A's. But now, Thomas Aquinas, we're in that chapter that deals with great apologists of church history. So that's chapter 2.
Page 21,
Thomas Aquinas. And really most frustrated time I ever watched Wheel of Fortune was when they had, I think they had the T, the M-A-S, A, they had like just enough letters to where it's like, oh, it's Thomas Aquinas. And in fact, they only had two or three letters, and I knew it was Thomas Aquinas. And they ended up buying vowels and everything, and it spelled Thomas Aquinas, and they kept saying, one would say, Thomas Aquinas? And the next person, Thomas Aquinas? And so it was a real frustrating time. But this is a guy like Augustine, probably the two greatest thinkers between the Apostle Paul and the Reformation. And he was the greatest scholastic thinker of the Middle Ages. Scholasticism was just an attempt by medieval Christian scholars to use their reasoning ability to reconcile traditional Catholic theology, Christian theology, with the philosophy of Aristotle. So there was such a love fest with Plato's thought that now all of a sudden there was a rebirth with Aristotle. This had been going on. And then, so it was basically, if you wanted to be a philosopher, you had to know Aristotle's thought. And the church was a little bit late catching up. You had Arab philosophers who were very Aristotelian in their thought, so Muslim philosophers. You had Jewish philosophers like Moses Maimonides, a couple hundred years before Aquinas, the great Jewish philosopher. And so St. Albert the Great was tasked with synthesizing Aristotelian thought with Christian theology. And his pupil, his greatest pupil, Thomas Aquinas, surpassed him in Albert the Great's lifetime, to the point when Aquinas died, like at age 49, I believe, Albert the Great devoted the rest of his life to defending the teachings of his pupil, of his greatest pupil. So that just shows you how. And I don't know if he was a bad communicator or if he just didn't look the role of a really smart guy, but his nickname was the Dumb Ox. That's what his, you know, I don't know how guys would be studying for the priesthood and be so cruel to each other, but one of them called him a dumb ox when he was trying to explain one of his ideas. And Albert the Great looked at the students and said, oh yeah, well, someday the world will hear this dumb ox roar. And so he knew the potential that was there. And he lived from 1225 to 1274 AD and studied under Albert the Great in Paris. And so, now, remember, when you have that famous painting of the two Greek philosophers, and one is pointing up and the other's pointing down, who's pointing down? You got Plato and Aristotle, who's pointing down?
Aristotle.
Aristotle's pointing down. And Plato is pointing up. So Plato is the world of unchanging ideas. That's where real knowledge is. Aristotle, he says, look, all knowledge, that's all human knowledge, begins in the senses. Okay? So he say, Aristotle said, you want to learn anything, you gotta have sense experience. We start life as a blank slate. Our minds are a blank slate, whereas Plato is open to the idea we have innate ideas. Now we may need the philosopher like Socrates, his mentor, so we might need like a midwife to help bring, to ask the right questions, to bring those ideas out. But we have ideas that we're born with. And so if we had two Dasani bottles here and we put them side by side, Plato would say that that would trigger from the mind the idea of equality, which is already there. It's in the world of unchanging ideas. Aquinas would say, no, we have to see two equal things before we can have that idea. It's from the sense perception that we get that. And I kind of lean in the direction of Plato. J.P. Moreland would be on the Platonic side. But on the Aristotelian side would be the Thomists, like Thomas Aquinas and Norman Geisler and all. But just keep in mind where Aquinas is going to come from. What do you think Aquinas is going to think about the ontological argument, arguing for God's existence from the idea, the concept of God alone? He's going to say no go. He's going to say it's got to start in the world of the senses. So he's going to like cosmological arguments, arguing from the universe or something in the universe to its infinite creator and sustainer, or arguing from the design of the world to the eternal designer. But he's going to start in the world of the senses.
So you would say Paul would lean towards, the Apostle Paul would lean more towards, according to Romans 1, more towards Plato.
It's really difficult how, from Romans 1, it's really difficult how Paul, because there's, you have knowledge through the physical world, but it also talks about the knowledge being in us, but how did the knowledge get in us? Was it through sensation? So you could argue the way there. I have a hard time with Thomism and Aristotelian epistemology, the Aristotle's theory of knowledge with Romans 2, 14 and 15, that even the pagan who doesn't have God's laws written in his word have God's laws written on their hearts, their conscience bearing witness. Seems to be we have this innate idea of right and wrong.
More towards Plato's side.
More towards Plato's side. Now I'm sure that Richard Howe and Norman Geisler have very brilliant Thomistic responses to that, and they do have a big deal on natural theology and natural revelation, but there's this quote from Gordon Clark that's he pretty much said, okay, because Aquinas, like Aristotle, taught that there's the receptive mind. It's kind of it's not two minds. But two aspects to the mind, the active mind and the receptive mind. And the receptive mind is like that garbage pail over there. We start life with an empty garbage pail, with an empty receptacle, with an empty box, with an empty pail. There's no knowledge in there.
Okay.
But he says there's an active aspect of the mind that has the ability from sense perception, from sense experience, to abstract rational data from it. So the mind, whereas someone more Platonic would probably say we start life with innate ideas, the Aristotelian or the Thomist would say, no, we don't start with innate ideas, but the mind does. We do start with the innate ability to abstract rational ideas from sense perception. Now, having said all that, I think Gordon Clark does make a good point when he says you'll never get moral values from around the dirt.
What does that mean?
With Gordon Clark saying, no matter how much sense experience you have with the physical world, you're never going to get moral values.
Oh, okay.
The physical world might tell you the way things appear to us, maybe even the way things, physical things are. That's debatable even. But it's not going to tell you what's right and what's wrong. Sense perception could tell us that man is killing that other man. But something more than sense perception has to tell us killing that man is wrong. That man is doing evil.
Because we've got God's word written on our heart.
I think, yeah, I have a little bit. Don't tell Norman Geisler or Richard Howe. Because I do not want to. I don't want to debate a Thomas. One thing about a Thomas, he's got a full-blown system. And now there are some areas where I am totally on board with Thomism. We'll see that as we get through it.
So you're talking about, when you're talking about sensory, you're talking about a baby and
no,
a womb, does it, or the birth, that they get, they must get something from sensory perception.
I would say yes. I think Aquinas, keep in mind, the science wasn't that advanced back then. I think Aquinas made too much out of Genesis 2. With the creation of man, God breathing life into his nostrils. I don't think that means that we're not human until we breathe. And so, you know, so I don't know if he had any knowledge of a beating heart of an unborn baby. But now we know, we define humanity by the genetic code. And that's in place from the moment of birth. So modern genetics has proven that at least as early as the 1940s, if not earlier, that beings that reproduce sexually, the new life starts at the moment of conception. You have a whole new genetic code. So if they're two dog beings, then that new life is a dog. A dog being. If they're two humans, that new life is a human being. And but whatever the case, it's the, so you got the receptive mind and the active mind. But we're going to see how Aquinas applies this. Now Aquinas held a high view of human reason, but he was not a rationalist. Okay. It's rationalists try to prove everything through reason alone. And there's sometimes Van Til is way out to lunch. He acts like Aquinas was like an ultra-rationalist and thought he could prove everything through reason alone. There's so many contemporary Christians that their critique of Aquinas is a straw man argument because they're reading Descartes, René Descartes, who was an ultra-rationalist, who believed we could prove everything through reason alone. They're reading that into Aquinas. When Aquinas is talking about reason, he means all of human thinking. So if we learn things through sitting down and thinking about numbers, that's reason. But if we learn things by looking and saying, wow, by me touching and looking at this, I can tell it's a pulpit. Well, he would say, yeah, for your reason, your friend. So we really didn't start using the word reason in modern philosophy to mean just unaided human reason, period. Not sensation, not the five senses, anything like that, until Descartes, you know? I mean, you could say Spinoza, Benedict Spinoza before him, but certainly not Aquinas.
So, to me, with reason alone, the method of the yellow Volkswagen inside.
Yeah, that's definitely correct. Blake's statement was, you can't prove to me through reason alone. There's a Volkswagen inside. Now, the thing is, René Descartes, to be an ultra-rationalist, if he's really going to try to claim knowledge that there is that Volkswagen outside, he's going to have to claim that he can rationally prove it. Now, it might take 2 months, but he's got to make that claim. Good luck. Aquinas, though, when he's thinking about reason and thinking, he's thinking about thinking. His whole theory of knowledge starts with sensation. So the senses are involved with it. So now, having said that, okay, usually the debate, and this is where Immanuel Kant, we're going to see when he comes into the picture later on, but you got reason, you know, the rationalist, and then you got, over here, you got the world of the senses, empiricism, knowledge through the five senses. So it's usually either or, okay? So, you call Aquinas a rationalist, that's definitely not true. If he was a rationalist, he would believe the ontological argument. Okay? But, for Gordon Clark to claim that he was an empiricist, period, that's much closer to Aquinas, but it's really not the whole ball of wax. And with Aquinas, some will call him an existentialist, but that they don't mean that, they don't mean that he's an irrationalist, like the way we use the word existentialist today, but what they mean is it's existence that matters to him. It's the realm of being, okay? Now, the realm of being for humans does entail the senses and our thinking ability and ideas and stuff, but we're going to see that really being is the important thing that's going on there. And we use being as a noun so much that we miss a lot of what Aquinas says, because being really is a verb. If you are a being, that's because you're in the continuing process of being. Okay? You are being. I am being a human. That makes me a human being. So we think, okay, well, being's a noun. Well, we're using it as a noun, but it really isn't. And so just to point out with a rationalist, okay? Okay, you got empiricist here. You got David Hume. And so what is he? If you just believe knowledge comes just through sensation and that you can never pull rational truths out of it, you end up with skepticism. Man really can't know anything. That's David Hume. Okay? René Descartes, a rationalist. So Descartes, he's going to say, I think, therefore, I am. Okay? See, he wanted to doubt. He was not a skeptic, you know that. But he used skepticism as a method to find truth. And he tried to doubt everything until he could find something that he couldn't doubt anymore. And then that would be his point of absolute certainty. So the more he doubted, the more he became aware of the existence of himself, the doubt. And doubting is a form of thinking, and if I think, therefore I must exist, therefore I am. But Aquinas would say, what were you going to say there?
It just seems like all the attacks on Aquinas are come from a place of ignorance.
An awful lot of them. There are some things that puzzle me about Aquinas, but I'm certainly... The amount of humility you should have whenever you try to refute one of the greatest thinkers of history, for some Protestants, that's absent when it comes to Aquinas. And it gets to the point when we do that, then who are we to get mad at Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion, where he dedicates a page and a half to refuting Aquinas' five ways to prove God's existence? By the way, Aquinas' five ways to prove God's existence assume about 1,000 pages of Aristotelian philosophy first. So his five ways to prove God's existence are like a little bit of snow on the top of a snow-covered mountain. And Richard Dawkins doesn't even know that. And they just dismiss Christian thinkers. But Aquinas would not say, yeah, just the senses and that's it. He's got not only the receptive mind, which receives sense data, but he's got the active mind. But for Aquinas, being is the most important. So he would say, Aquinas would never say, I think, therefore I am. He would say, I think because I am a thinking being. So really, Aquinas' starting point is not my thinking, but my being. Okay? So for Aquinas, being, which the study of being is called what? Do you remember from philosophy? The study of being, the studying of reality?
Metaphysics.
Very good, Blake. Precedes knowledge. What branch of philosophy is that? Epistemology. That's good, Blake. When you know the answers, when you know the answers to you're a really sharp student, give other people a chance first. And that took me a while to learn. I was always raising my hand first to get mad at Habermas for not calling. Dude, I knew the answer. Why didn't you call me?
Because I knew you knew the answer.
It's like, oh, okay, I'm getting it now. So, you got to be a thinking being before you can know something. Okay? And so, it's really Aristotelian philosophy. And epistemology, his theory of knowledge, is much different than the way most of us think. Yet there's some good arguments in its favor. So now Aquinas pretty much developed, he synthesized Aristotle's philosophy with Christian thought. He got about as complete of a system out of that as anybody has. I mean, you could probably say Gilson and was it Maritain or whatever. There's been some 20th century Thomists that may have, you know, putting in their mind at least the finishing touches on Aquinas. But Albert didn't have that full-blown system, but Aquinas did. So keep in mind, though, Aquinas held a high view of human reason. He was not a rationalist. He believed being precedes knowledge. So he didn't try to prove his beliefs with logical necessity. Now, I got a student in Canada, a brilliant, brilliant guy, John Feeks. I think he has CARE. There's another dude with the Muslim CARE. He started his, I think, before they started theirs. But is Christian apologetics, research, and evangelism, something like that. And he's a brilliant, brilliant thinker, but he didn't like that Aquinas did not believe you could prove God's existence with logical necessity. So you can't prove God's existence with rational certainty. Okay? But you gotta understand, he's not a rationalist. So to say you can prove God's existence with logical necessity or rational certainty, that's just like, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. That's just like the realm of ideas, the realm of numbers. The realm of ideas, he's not a Platonist. For Aquinas and Aristotle, the realm of ideas is subservient to the realm of being. So the existential realm, the realm of existence, the realm of being, that's the important realm for him. So the fact that Aquinas believed you can prove God's existence with existential necessity, okay, or what Norman Geisler would call actual, to be actual means to have being, to be real, actual undeniability. Okay? And so Aquinas would say we can prove if finite beings exist, then infinite being must exist. But that's not logical necessity. That's existential necessity or actual undeniability. In other words, God must act, an infinite being, which is God, must actually exist if any finite being actually exists. And this is why a lot of the medieval philosophers would say, you give me the existence of a blade of grass and I'll prove God's existence. Because there's no way to sustain it in existence without it. We'll talk about Aquinas' arguments from that as well. So he argues for God's existence and other truths based upon actually undeniable premises. Okay? So he rejected the ontological argument for God's existence. He believed all human knowledge begins in the senses, and the human mind begins life as a blank slate upon which nothing is written. So he taught that everything in the mind was first in the senses, except the mind itself. What does he mean by that? Well, everything in the mind, so that's the receptive mind, was first in the senses, except the active mind itself. So in other words, he's understanding that in his thought, there's no innate ideas, but there is the innate ability to arrive at conclusions from sense experience. In other words, God has set us up in such a way that we can have a sense experience, and from our sense, through our sense perception, we can draw more from the sense experience than's actually there. Without this active mind principle, David Hume could say, we can't even figure out the law of causality. We can't even get that. We can't even know that for sure. So, if Joe pushes Tom off a building and Tom falls, all you can know from the sense experience is that Joe first pushed Tom, then Tom fell. You can't know that Joe pushing Tom caused Tom to fall. All you get is constant conjunction. You know, B almost always follows A, but we can't say that A caused B. It takes more than the senses. Well, Aquinas says that's the active mind. Our ability being created in God's image to draw that data out. So he's not a strict And so man starts life with no data in his mind, though his mind does have the innate ability to draw rational information from sense experience. The mind has the capacity to draw more out of sense data than sense data itself. And but still, Aquinas would say knowledge must begin with sense experience. So you can't argue, according to Aquinas, you can't argue from the idea of God to his existence. That's the ontological argument. Instead, we have to argue from the data of the physical world to its ultimate cause. So Aquinas, again, uses the cosmological, teleological arguments for God.
Now I got a quick question about that.
Sure.
Now, is he throwing in, Aquinas throwing in the idea that are differentiating between knowledge and truth? Or is it just
Knowledge is like knowledge of the truth.
Okay, so if someone, maybe I'm getting this wrong, maybe I'm understanding this wrong, where he says that we have the innate ability to draw information from the sense experience, but we start life with a blank slate. Just throw an example, a kid's grown up as one of the, and I'm just going to use something like Hitler, used in the, like a Nazi camp, and by his sense experience, how he treats individuals, certain individual groups, by his sense experience, he sees that's right, because that's all he knows.
That was one of Martin Luther's critiques of the
Well, let me finish, you can say it. So, but that's all he knows. Even though we know in our hearts that that is wrong, how that certain group treated that certain group. We know that innately. We know that it's wrong, I believe. So if he's gathering the just by sense experience, and we're a blank slate, that's what Hitler wanted. He wanted this blank slate. So to me, there has to be a different or something to differentiate between truth and knowledge.
Yeah, for me, I'm not, and that's why I'm not fully in a Thomistic camp.
Okay.
To me, there's not enough in the, you know, even Gordon Clark would mock Aquinas on that, you know, oh, how active is the active mind, but you'll still never be able to abstract moral laws from a mound of dirt. And so that would go a long way. Now, Aquinas would argue otherwise. Now, you were mentioning Luther's.
He pointed out that there's a hidden presupposition in the Aristotelian thought, which is that the mind is unfallen. He put it to us this way. In Romans 1, we have Paul saying that mankind is without excuse because we all know that there is a God. And he demonstrated that. Well, yep, everybody knows that there's some sort of God, and if you read atheist arguments, what they're trying to do is tell themselves they don't believe in God. They're not really arguing against its existence. That being the case, then, why is it that everybody outside of Christendom believes in a false God? Because your mind, your reason is fallen. If we're all observing the same things, we should all come to the same conclusions according to Aquinas' philosophy. So he said, the mind, unaided human reason, and unaided human perception, both are going to screw you.
Yeah, and I would appreciate that, and Calvin would also use that same kind of reasoning. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. And Luther and Calvin had a love fest with Augustine. And Augustine had, even though he had a bigger emphasis on faith than Aquinas, he still had a big emphasis on reason. So I think where Luther's right, a human could add 1 + 1 and accidentally come up with 3 because we're fallen. But even in our fallen state, we could add 1 + 1 and come up with 2.
He didn't trash the notion of reason altogether. That's something I'm trying to debunk, that fideism idea.
But the
idea was that it's not so powerful that you can get all truth from it. Like Aquinas seems to be.
No.
Or the vast majority, but the top of the rock.
And that's a good point, because the reformers acted like Aquinas believed all truth could be found. Well, I can't even say that they didn't mention Aquinas much, if at all. So they might not have been slamming Aquinas. They might have been slamming some precursor to Descartes, but all truth could be found through reason alone. truth could be found from reason alone, that's Descartes. That's not Aquinas. Aquinas.
The idea that the mind is so powerful that you can find the truth through perception is just as flawed.
True, true.
Because what I'm arguing in my paper that he's a kind of a precursor to Reformed epistemology.
Faith. Yeah, and then the thing is, too, we'll talk about Augustine a little bit here, but Aquinas, and this is the reason why I'm saying that the Reformers didn't mention Aquinas much, if at all, in this context. So now, they may have been refuting the scholasticism of their day, which had reached a certain point, and certainly Roman Catholicism had a real lofty view of human reason by the 1500s, but Aquinas drew a very... Anybody who pins this on Aquinas shows they don't know Aquinas, because he drew a big distinction between truths that you could know through reason alone. Remember, by reason, though, he means the whole being. So it starts with sense perception. But truths that can be found through reason alone versus truth that could only be found through faith. And so Aquinas puts salvation and the Trinity, that's got to be revealed to us through God's supernatural revelation, whereas we could know that God is one, God exists, moral laws, he would say that we could know this through God's natural revelation, but he would not deny that it was still revelation from God.
The Reformers also argued against that notion as well.
Yeah, well, that is because they're Augustinian. Augustine chose to say all revelation is revelation, whether it's natural or supernatural, it's still revelation. Augustine's kind of, his thinking put a big focus on the fact, Augustine put a big emphasis on the fact that it's all revelation. Aquinas, being Aristotelian, not Platonic, he put the emphasis on, but yeah, it's all revealed by God, but there's a distinction between what God reveals through us through nature, and we could arrive at through reason, through human thinking ability, which includes sense data, versus those things that we could never figure out on our own that God has to reveal to us. And so would Aquinas agree with Augustine that we cannot reason our way into heaven? Yes. He'd be in total agreement on that. So it depends how much they pin on him. There are scholars that are taking a second look at the way Calvin and Luther, their assessment of Aquinas, because they're wondering if their problem wasn't so much with Aquinas, but later kind of dogmatic pronouncements by you know, future scholastic thinkers after him. But whatever the case, one thing Aquinas would argue here, though, is that you cannot find salvation through reason. Okay? So he would say you can know that God exists and all through reason. Another thing is, too, Aquinas, that he doesn't get enough credit for, he drew a distinction between belief in and belief that. And he did say that belief that could be driven by reason. In other words, someone could prove to you that God exists, believe that God exists, but you still have to believe in God, which is an act of the will. And that doesn't seem to run too counter to Romans 1, where belief that God exists seems to be clear, but then by an act of the will, we suppress the truth. So in the end, Aquinas is in agreement with the reformers on the point. Now, I'm not saying he's across the board, he's in agreement with them, but he is in agreement with the reformers that belief in is going to be an act of the will. So if somebody doesn't believe in the true God, it's got more to do, it's a moral problem, not a rational problem. That's not one of our cars, is it?
No, it's someone on the other side of yours.
Okay, but it's not me. Good.
No. So, I guess my... Oh, I'm sorry.
Where is emotion here?
What's that?
Where is emotion here?
Emotion? Aquinas would be aware of emotion, of our feelings and things of that sort. But it doesn't really... He wouldn't see it as... you know, and I haven't read enough Aquinas to dogmatically say, but I would just say he would say that when you try to make decisions, you should make decisions based on the evidence, and emotions will come into play and will influence the will, but our will, we should go with where the evidence is. Now, I would agree with people if they say that Aquinas and just about every Christian philosopher at some point in their writings put too much emphasis on man's thinking, maybe with the exception of Blaise Pascal. Blaise Pascal really lowers the boom, probably too hard on reason, but he certainly does a good job on that. And but Aquinas is dealing with real human beings, so yeah, emotions comes into play, but when it comes to believing in God, reason proves to us that God exists. But that doesn't mean a person. And even by going to God's supernatural revelation in the Bible, reason should prove to us, because of the miracles and Jesus' resurrection, that Jesus is Savior. But believing in Jesus, that's got to be an act of the will. You've got to decide that.
Well, I would also say that includes emotion.
The will does, but it doesn't have to. You know, I mean, I suppose you could come up with a theory of humans where, in the end, our will, you know, Pascal would argue our will is more controlled by our emotions than by our reason. But, you know, you might say, hey, your favorite team is the Cleveland Browns. And your emotions, your desires, you desire them to be the best football team there is. But the fact of the matter is your reason tells you a 1-in-15 football team is not very good. They're much more likely to be the worst team in the NFL, and my apologies to any Cleveland Brown fans. So the reason, the will doesn't, I mean the emotions don't have to overwhelm the reason, but in the end, the will look at more than just the reason. But that's not a big part on Aquinas. It's just a big part that we're saying that, you know, to believe in the fullest sense of the word, such as like saving faith, is going to take much more than just a belief that an act of the mind. It's going to take an act of the will to where the person actually commits to it. Now Aquinas is famous for his five ways to prove God's existence, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but keep in mind everything that we've talked about so far you know, Blake was bringing up the reformers and their attack on this kind of thinking, and that's why some people, and I think incorrectly, Luther, you probably know more about Luther than I do, With Calvin, I think Calvin was incorrectly classified as a theist. Yet he talks about mediate knowledge of God and immediate knowledge of God in his institutes. So he saw that we have immediate knowledge of God, the sensus divinitatis, the sense of deity. So God creates us with knowledge of him, but that's dim and our sin nature likes to suppress that. But we could also have immediate knowledge of God. In other words, knowledge of God through something else, like the created universe. Now, he doesn't make formal arguments, but he's not a fideist. But fideism would just reject all of apologetics, all of defending the faith. Now, Augustine uses a lot of reason to defend Christianity. And he kind of sides more on the side of reason than he does on the side of the senses. But he's not a full ultra-rationalist. But Augustine is really interesting in that faith plays a big role. And in the end, true knowledge, if I had to label Augustine's view of knowledge, it would not be empiricism. It would not be Aristotelian. It would not be full rationalism, it would be his doctrine of illumination. That God illuminates. So there might be some innate ideas and all, but that's not even central to Augustine. What's central is that God illuminates our minds to know the truth. And so he has he doesn't use the word like the Logos doctrine of the early church fathers based on John chapter 1, but the idea sure is there. John 1 talking about the Logos, the true light that comes, that enlightens every man, comes into the world. You know, he believed in God's light we see light, like the psalmist says. And so God has to turn the light on for us to know anything. Not just spiritual truth, but even physical truth. And that's why I'm saying Augustine's emphasis is that whether it's natural or supernatural revelation, it's all revelation. If God didn't reveal anything to us, we would have the knowledge of a rock right now. Okay? Aquinas, on the other hand, he felt led to draw the distinction between what God reveals through us naturally and what God reveals to us supernaturally. And so sometimes what God reveals to us naturally can move us in the direction of the true God, and that's why we like to suppress that truth through an act of the will. But Aquinas is five ways. The first four are cosmological. And while the fifth is a teleological. And so first Aquinas argued from movement to an unmoved mover. Okay? Then he argued from effects to a first cause. Okay? The one I like, my favorite one of his, is the third argument. From contingent or possible beings to a totally necessary being. We'll spend a little bit of time on that. His fourth way, he argues from different degrees of perfections to a most perfect being. is the closest he ever comes to being Platonic. That's very close to a Platonic argument for God. And then finally, when the mindless things of nature moving towards the same goals shows the existence of a mind which governs nature. So another way to say that last one is that, you know, when Aquinas, you know, acorns growing up to be oak trees and not apple trees. Well, the acorn doesn't know anything. How does it know to move in that direction? So the mindless things of nature moving towards the same goals seems to indicate that there's a mind governing the mindless things of nature. I forget if it was Alvin Plantinga who said that even if evolution were true, this fifth way arguing for God's existence still works. Because evolution is moving towards goals. If evolution is really occurring, you're going from the simple to the complex. It's progressing. It's evolving, not devolving, if it's true, if you assume it's true. There would have to be a mind behind the mindless things of nature moving in that direction. Now, was Aquinas an evolutionist? No thinker was an evolutionist back then. No Christian, Muslim, or Jewish thinker back then.
No thinker is an evolutionist.
It depends how you define the word thinker, but I can see a sense in which I would agree. I would actually, it's what Francis Schaeffer said, that today's most famous philosophers are actually anti-philosophers. Because philosophy means the love of wisdom, and if you want to be a great philosopher today and have lots of people read your books and become rich, the quickest way to do it, you know, besides getting all the degrees from the Ivy League schools or the European schools, quickest way to do it is to hate wisdom and attack wisdom and give sophisticated arguments against wisdom. And but whatever the case, Aquinas would see the laws of nature as far as like gravity and the first and second law of thermodynamics and stuff like that. He would say, man, that's evidence of design and nature right there. So it's a teleological type of argument. There's different degrees of perfections to the most perfect being. He would say, look, man, it's just normal for us to make judgments and say, well, that's bad, that's good, but that's even better. Well, what scale are you using? How can we say, well, that line is crooked, that other line is straighter, but it's still a little crooked? None of that makes sense unless you've got some idea of a totally straight line. And that's where you're bordering on Platonism there. So, you could probably argue, okay, is he really being Aristotelian on that point? But movement to an unmoved mover, let me say this, we don't even think the way the ancients and the medieval thinkers thought, because when I think of movement, I think of physical movement, okay? Not so with Aristotle and Aquinas. I mean, yeah, you could have physical movement is movement. But any change is movement. So it's kind of like he's arguing from change to an unchanged changer. Okay? A point is something that totally remains the same, to which things that change can be measured as changing. But just to go from non-being to being is movement. So whatever the case, so his unmoved mover, another way of saying that would be moving from changing things which prove themselves, because they're changing things, proves them to be contingent, dependent things, things dependent on something else for a continued existence, eventually you've got to get to the uncaused cause of all else that exists. Okay? It just, he's using language that philosophers of his day would be very familiar with. It's a very strange language for us. With the effects to a first cause, his main point there is that if everything is an effect, then you never arrive at the cause. Okay? So, if there's a chain dangling from the sky, you say, well, why is this chain link here? Well, because there's a chain link above it, Phil, that's holding it up. Yeah, but why is that chain link there? Well, because there's a chain link holding that up. Okay, yeah, but why is there, you know, so eventually, you got to anchor that. Okay? Why is this book, okay, or you say, this glass case, why is this glass case suspended about 3 feet off the ground, or 2.5 feet off the ground? Well, because it's resting on this paper. Yeah, but why is this suspended off the ground? Well, because it's resting on this Bible. Okay, but why is the Bible suspended off the ground? Is resting on this table. Why is this table 2.5 to 3 feet off the ground? Because of the legs that it's resting upon. So eventually you gotta anchor it, okay? And what Aquinas is saying there is that if you explain effects by nothing but other effects, you haven't explained anything really. You've got to get to a cause, the first cause, that itself is not an effect, and that grounds the continuing existence of all that exists. So you think about Aquinas, he's existential in the sense it's all about existence, it's all about being. He's not, because he's Aristotelian, he's not focused on becoming. So he's not even looking for the beginning of the universe, he's looking for the continuing cause of the universe, okay, the sustaining cause. And so what I want to do is just spend just a couple minutes. We talked about it in the last course. But I spent a little bit of time on what I think is Aquinas' best argument for God. In fact, I think this is the best argument for God. And I rarely use it because most college students have a hard time following it. But from contingent beings to a totally necessary being. And the way I do that is, let's say this line represents everything that exists. Okay? And let's say that we're going to assume that everything that exists is a contingent being. In other words, everything that exists has the possibility of not existing. Well, that means that given enough time, every possibility for non-existence would be actualized and nothing would exist. But that means if we went backwards in time far enough, that same scenario would have obtained so that every possibility for non-existence would have been actualized and nothing would exist. But since from nothing, nothing comes, if something now is, then that tells us there has to be total, infinite, necessary existence sustaining the continuing existence of all the finite, dependent, contingent beings. Okay? Now keep in mind, this is not the Kalam cosmological argument. That everything that has a beginning needs a cause, the universe has a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. He's Aristotelian, and Aristotle taught that the universe was eternal. Did Aquinas believe the universe was eternal? No. Because the Bible says in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But that's a truth we learn by faith. He didn't believe we could learn it by reason. I disagree with him. I think Bonaventure was right. And you could prove rationally that the universe had a beginning. But basically, once you have infinite being, totally non-contingent, totally necessary, a being that cannot not exist, and I'm talking existentially, not just logically, but a being that has no possibility of not existing, then that could ground not only the existence, in Aquinas' mind, not only the existence of a finite world with a beginning, but also a finite world with no beginning. He could have just generated throughout all eternity that type of world. Now, I do think there's rational arguments to show the universe had a beginning. But what he's showing is, if finite beings continue to exist, the only way to ground that existence is with the actual existence of infinite being. Okay? Only infinite being can ground the continuing existence of finite beings. So if possible beings exist and continue to exist, there has to be infinite being to ground that existence. And I think that's his strongest argument there. But you got to, again, you got to come at it. But most people, I don't even think Richard Dawkins is aware that this argument is Aquinas' argument from existential causality, which means the current cause of the continuing existence, the sustaining cause of the continuing existence of something else. He's not talking rational certainty or logical necessity. I heard Kai Nielsen write in September 1999 at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and a major atheist conference, and I was the token theist or the token Christian to debate Jeffrey J. Louder, but it was a who's who. Paul Kurtz was there. Michael Martin was there. It was a who's who in atheism at that time. And Kai Nielsen was there, who had debated J.P. Moreland. And he was arguing, he gave a whole presentation arguing that there's no difference between existential causality and logical necessity. And most of the guys there were not philosophers. Most were like scientists or historians or something. So most of them were just like, man, this is a boring talk. The ones that were philosophers, I hope they cringed. Because existential causality, existential undeniability or actual undeniability is as different from logical necessity as Aquinas is from Descartes. One is talking about the realm of being and actuality. The other is talking about just the realm of the mind, the realm of the ideas. The way Norman Geisler puts it, he says if you start in the realm of ideas, you'll end in the realm of ideas. If you start in the realm of being, you'll end in the realm of being. Okay? Now, that's why I don't want to argue with the Thomists. I mean, they do say things that are kind of hard to refute. But whatever the case, I think that is Aquinas' third way is a strong way to argue for God's existence. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break, and then we'll move on with Aquinas. And hopefully we'll finish Aquinas and be able to get to some of the classical apologists.